some magical moments with us at the Rockall yesterday. We're ready now for our second panel of this week's conference, public conference. The topic is Future of Growth Markets. Now, if you need translation, we have our translation headsets. Please note that there will be one part of the panel that will be in Spanish. Now, if you don't understand Spanish, you will definitely need one of these headsets. Our hostesses will walk around, raise your hand if you need translation for Spanish part, and our hostesses will take care of it. So, this panel will be moderated and presented by Marc Soluzzi, on my left, chairman of the Association of the Luxembourg Fund Industry. Please enjoy this panel.
So I just need to reset my tab. Bear with me 1 minute. Perfect. Well, welcome this morning at the conference. We have a very busy agenda today, and we have a very packed panel discussion that we have prepared for you. So I will not lose any time on general remarks, and I will go directly into the matter. The sequence that we will follow is that I will provide some background to the discussion by showing you a few slides. Then I will introduce our panel, and then we'll have a first round of questions on the key driving factors or the key success factors for developing capital markets, leveraging the experience of our panelists. And in the last part of the panel discussion, we will ask each panelist to summarize very quickly the reform on which they are currently working to further boost their capital markets in their respective country. Hopefully, if we manage the time well, we'll have some time at the end for some Q&A. So let's get started. Let me open this panel discussion by taking a look at the current state of capital markets in the world and where they could be headed by 2030. If we consider equity market as a proxy, it's important for the first two slides. We are just considering equity markets here, and we use equity market as a proxy for the rest of capital markets. If we consider equity markets as a proxy for capital markets, the current balance of power lies in the developed world, which accounts for 69% of the global equity market cap. Goldman Sachs predicts that the total equity market cap may rise from $43 trillion today to $145 trillion in 2030. At this point, emerging countries may represent 55% of the total, meaning that the balance of power will have shifted away. Those projections are based on two major assumptions. First, a significant expansion in the global market, global capital market, due to continuing deepening of equity markets in the developed world. Second, the rapid economic growth of emerging countries will boost their equity markets, which are currently at the early stages of their development. Let's now take a look at the top capital markets in the world today and in 2030. The top four is currently dominated by two Anglo-Saxon markets and two Asian markets, which is already an indication that we have gone through some of that evolution already. Economists at Goldman Sachs predict that by 2030, China will surpass the US. China's aggregate market cap, both mainland and Hong Kong, is projected to rise from 4.7 trillion to 41.4 trillion in 2030. Another important thing to notice is the arrival in the top four of two developing countries, India and Russia, with 10% and 9% annual increase respectively. Clearly, by 2030, the power will have shifted in favor of the BRICS. The question is now, what shape the reform agenda should take to support the full development of future growth markets? And underlying this, what are the key drivers for the development of capital markets? To frame our response to this question and feed our panel discussion, we considered the analysis developed by World Bank economist Augusto de la Torre. In his 2007 book titled Emerging Capital Markets and Globalization, de la Torre presents the relationship between reforms and capital market development. From this rather complex diagram. Let me try. Okay. From this rather complex diagram picture on this slide, we have kept five main areas which usually enable the development of capital markets. These areas are regulation, the quality of the market infrastructure, issuers' participation, investors' participation. Those four key success factors contributing to the fifth one, which is liquidity. Let's start with regulation. Okay, here we go. The regulatory framework is a key building block to create an ecosystem that supports investments. It mainly encompasses the protection of investors and the supervision of participating actors, but can also aim at fostering innovation. We'll see that in a minute. As such, reforming the regulatory framework implies improving the rules related to property rights, the protection of minority shareholders and creditors, and the deterrence of insider trading. On the actor side, another goal for improving the regulatory framework is to mitigate information asymmetry and agency problems. This is done through more transparency, enhanced market integrity, and more reliable contract enforcement. Last but not least, regulation can foster financial innovation, even if the latter is not the flavor of the month anymore. Still, financial innovation, focusing on the needs of the people and the real economy, can have a positive impact on growth. Second, infrastructure. Improving the infrastructure encompasses the modernization of trading, custody, clearing, and settlement systems. On the technological side, it may include shifts to electronic trading systems, online brokerage services, and real-time growth system settlements. Real-time growth settlement systems. On the policy side, it may include new policies related to custody arrangements and varying degrees of improvement in accounting and disclosure standards. The goals of these infrastructure improvements are to lower transaction costs for participating market players and increase the safety and efficiency of transactions. Third, facilitating the access of a variety of issuers, in particular smaller ones, to capital markets. One important goal of capital markets is to foster economic productivity by financing innovation. In other words, providing access to funding to a large range of issuers. From the big ones, which prefer to diversify the financing of their activities by tapping into financial markets, to the smaller ones, which are more and more difficult to finance their growth through the banking system. Fourth, increasing the pool of investors and make it easier for them to invest in capital markets. I'm particularly fond of this one, being the chairman of the Luxembourg Fund Association. To foster the emergence of institutional investors, such as mutual and pension funds, deepens the local investor pool and provides more liquidity in the market. At the same time, the role of capital market is to help investors diversifying their risk and investment through a large spectrum of assets and instruments. They also help to reduce the cost of acquiring and processing information before making informed investment decisions. Finally, of those four enablers, capital markets should provide liquidity. In that respect, financial globalization has contributed to the concentration of market capitalization and liquidity in a few international financial centers such as London, New York, and Tokyo. Financial activity in these centers vastly overshadows market activity elsewhere, at least for the time being. This is why liquidity in developing markets is an area of concern. To improve regulation, market infrastructures, issuers' access to capital markets and investor participation can only help future growth markets to improve their liquidity. To further discuss these key drivers to the development of future growth markets, I'm now very honored to introduce our very distinguished panel. Collectively, the countries represented by our panelists add up to a total GDP of $5.7 billion, which has been growing at an average compound annual growth rate of 10.4% over the last 10 years. The total population in those countries have reached 65 million people. The current equity market cap in those countries is $2.6 trillion, 6% of the world total today, and by 2030 is projected to reach $9.4 trillion USD. I believe that they have a lot to tell us on future growth markets. You have their full resume in your booklet, so I'm not going to spend any time introducing their entire career. We will be here up to noon this morning. So let me just say that we have with us Arunna Ote, ladies first, Director General SEC Nigeria. We have Jae-Oon Yoo, with the Standing Commissioner for the SFC in Korea. We have Jaime Gonzalez Aguade, who is the President of CNBV in Mexico. Leonardo Pereira, Chairman of CVM Brazil. And last but not least, Ranjit Singh, Chairman of the Securities Commission in Malaysia. So a very distinguished and very experienced panel to deal with our subject today. Again, trying to save some time, let's go directly to the first question, which is about regulation. So, and this is a question for Ranjit. So Ranjit, we talk about regulation as being key for the development of capital markets, in particular regulations intending to protect creditors and investors. Can you explain, based on your experience in Malaysia, but also as a result of your role as Vice Chairman of the Board of ISCO, the importance of laying down the right regulatory foundation? Proper regulation can also lead to innovation. Malaysia is the global leader in Islamic finance, with more than 65% of the global sukuk outstanding. From that point of view, can you tell us also to which extent this leading position was made possible by new and innovative regulations?
Thank you very much, Mark, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to be able to see so many people in the room at this very early stage of the morning after the very nice evening that we had yesterday with the performance. Mark, it's in a sense, the question is an obvious one, and the answer is pretty obvious as well, that of course we need a strong regulatory foundation in terms of ensuring the future growth of the capital markets. As you showed in your slides as well, in many ways, regulation is a very important component of those different aspects. My view is that it is really important for a few reasons. First of all, sustainability of markets. It's critical to ensure that there is sustainability. Good regulation really makes things predictable. The predictability, you know, provides a key element in terms of fostering trust and confidence. And it is the deepening of trust that essentially gives the capital markets resilience and, most importantly, the potential for sustainable long-term growth. Now, what exactly constitutes the right regulatory foundation, in my view, is really one that provides confidence through regulatory certainty and fostering trust through good governance. It must also, as you touch on the issue, also allow for financial innovation that produces good positive outcomes whilst avoiding the negative outcomes that, you know, that we've seen happen. In many ways also, I believe that it is important that as regulators, we start talking less about the cost of regulation and more about the value of regulation. And in many ways, clearly you can see that, you know, markets, I believe, should begin to use a sound regulatory framework as a major source of competitive advantage in many ways. You know, my view is issuers and investors will ultimately go to where there is quality regulation, and we must not, as regulators, deviate from that particular path. However, of course, it's challenging because in many ways, regulation and the foundations, are, as I said, are obvious, but the regulatory framework and the key aspects of how we regulate markets, in my view, certainly does change as the state of the market and the environment that we are in changes as well. And you asked me for the experience of Malaysia. Yesterday, I spoke more broadly, my thoughts around the subject. But let me now bring it closer to home, so to speak, and tell you in the Malaysian context how we've approached this. For us, the regulatory foundation really is something that we've worked on, if I look at it, in a few stages of development. It is a continuous process, sequenced, very much taking into cognizance where the market is at, unfortunately also driven by some experiences that we had during the crisis, Asian financial crisis. And in a way, the kind of measures that we took post-Asian financial crisis were validated during the resilience that the market showed during the global financial crisis and events more recently. If you look at the foundations, of course, I think in the beginning, it was all about streamlining, creating the right sort of regulatory environment, ensuring that we had the fundamental aspects. A lot of it was focused around investor protection and orderly markets, ensuring that that we were able to provide an environment where investors were comfortable to participate in the markets, and at the same time addressing issues around areas like corporate governance. And I want to touch on issues like corporate governance, because you will see that our approach on corporate governance is also changing over time. In the first instance, when we had the Asian financial crisis, there were clearly some very significant corporate governance related issues that arose during that time in Asia. And the idea of course was to be able to set the right foundations around corporate governance, which were premised on three aspects, both ensuring that there is strong regulatory discipline, ensuring that there is also market discipline and as well as self-discipline. But I must say that if I were to show you a slide, the regulatory discipline part was disproportionately larger than the other two. And we focused very much on ensuring the rules and were in place and a codification of best practices. But it was clearly the first stage of how we were approaching the regulation of markets at that point. The environment also was intended to ensure that we set the foundations for positive innovation in the marketplace. And this is also very challenging. That becomes a particularly challenging aspect, I believe, for the growth in emerging markets, because many of us have dual mandates. And so whilst we have the mandate for regulation, we also have a developmental mandate. In the case of Malaysia, it's a very explicit mandate that we have. And therefore, we are always, you know, it's, well, there are many ways that you balance it and you ensure that, you know, it is addressed, but very, very conscious that we also needed to be able to ensure that the regulatory foundation was able to provide an environment for financial innovation to take place. But interestingly, a lot of the financial innovation, given our mandate, was actually driven by the regulator and working together with the industry. And therefore, we put in place, you know, several major areas for innovation, including the topic that you asked me to talk about, which is on Islamic finance. But what was important, really, and I think we'll get the panelists to talk a little bit about it later as well, my view is you can set the frameworks for these innovation, but the success of it really happens post-introduction. And therefore, issues like scale, liquidity, post-introduction promotion becomes very critical. And sometimes we underestimate the importance of that. And you've seen, so it's not just a case of getting, you know, the products out there or the market set up. You need to be able to ensure that there's post-implementation follow-through. I think often, and Malaysia went through then the second stage, really, where it was a case then of refining the regulatory framework further, focusing on greater sophistication in terms of our approach to surveillance, our approach towards supervision of market intermediaries, and actually at that very early stage, in the early 2000, we actually put in place a framework for systemic risk before it became popular parlance for securities regulators, because clearly we saw the importance of focusing towards systemic risk in the context of the experience that we had during the Asian financial crisis. And of course, at that point in time, we were also, you know, setting frameworks around audit oversight boards and SROs. So it's a case of, again, moving with a greater degree of comfort to the next level, where you have the other aspects of the regulatory foundation being introduced. Now, we're really, at this point in time, if you like, at the third stage, and we've just completed a financial sector assessment program. And it's a pretty good result. We've had full compliance for 34 of the 37 principles that were put forward. So that's a very, very good sort of outcome for us. But more importantly than that, I think it gives us now the confidence to be able to move to the next stage. And the context of moving to the next stage is a challenging one. And it's challenging because you're now looking to be able to ensure that there is greater focus on bringing into play the role of the markets and the whole ecosystem in terms of creating the regulatory foundations, if you like. I wouldn't say foundation, but regulatory framework in the context of where we are going. So, for example, again, using the corporate governance instance, we've come out with a corporate governance blueprint that now focuses less on regulation, but greater emphasis on self-discipline, on creating a culture of governance beyond just box-ticking, and ensuring that there is much greater, for example, shareholder activism, which is not something that's very common in many parts of, I would say, even the growth in emerging markets. And this is an important area for us to be able to ensure that we create that sort of environment, so we have now focused a lot more efforts towards those areas. At the same time, our approach to supervision is also reflecting the same sort of thrust and ensuring that we are in a position to balance our approach to its supervision in such a way that we allow and recognize proportionality in terms of the of regulation by recognizing those that, you know, have put in the right systems, focusing a lot more on risk management, again, governance issues, et cetera. And I see that as characterizing, if you like, the third part of where we move in terms of regulatory development. So it really is a challenge, and I think, you know, it is a case of being able to calibrate the regulatory framework, take into context where the markets are at. I think for growth in emerging markets, this is very important. We are always conscious that there is no undue burden that's being placed on the marketplace, and this is where also we have to be careful about, you know, just implementing regulation that may not be absolutely context specific. And I would mention one point, and now I move to innovation, your second part of the question. And this is very interesting because I think when I look at the experience, perhaps, you know, coming out from within Asia, I think 97, 98 probably created an environment of a certain degree of risk aversion among the regulatory and policymaking community. And that was simply because the effects of 97, 98 were very, very severe. And as a consequence, I think the same degree of innovation that perhaps you may have seen in the West was not as prevalent. There was, of course, some degree, but it wasn't the same. So now, of course, the positive outcome of that is that you did not find the same sort of problems happening in during the global financial crisis. But a question that has to be asked before us is what impact does it have in terms of long-term growth? And this is an issue which I think is a dilemma that one needs to look at very carefully. Now, so in our view, we believe that, as I said, you know, we believe that facilitating innovation is absolutely critical. We do that. Now, let me touch on Islamic finance and look at this area. Islamic finance for Malaysia has been a very important area of development. It is an area for which we have a strong comparative advantage, given the very strong institutional structure, long history that we've had, very strong demand that's come in. And the approach that we've taken really has been one where we have ensured that we liberalize, allow in many ways a greater degree of facilitation in terms of product development, and what have you, helped, of course, by creating a proper ecosystem. One of the most important ones we've done is creating the Sharia Advisory Council that, in a sense, removes an uncertainty on the part of the players. So we've done that. And I think that's really helped a great deal in terms of creating that innovative framework. Let me just sort of conclude by saying that in many ways, what your question around regulatory foundation, therefore, really is one about trying to ensure that we continue to be able to facilitate the positive outcomes that we're looking at, ensure that we position ourselves in the global context in terms of regulatory standards, and at the same time address some of the issues which are domestically and context specific. I will use that as my introductory remarks, and I'm happy to take more questions later.
Thank you very much, Ranjit, for this comprehensive response on regulation. The second enabler that we have identified for developing capital markets is the quality of the market infrastructure, and Brazil financial markets in general and its derivative market in particular are recognized internationally as a very sophisticated marketplace. Building on Brazil's experience in this field, Leodano, can you explain the importance of developing a modern market infrastructure? According to you, what should be its most important features? To what extent are technology enhancements conducive to success? And last but not least, how can emerging countries currently developing their domestic markets catch up with or even leapfrog the standards laid down by more established marketplaces when it comes to the market infrastructure? So.
Mark, as you've shown on your slides, and I think we all agree that the securities markets will be growing substantially in the next 20 years. We also believe that emerging markets will be contributing with a major share of that growth. However, the speed of growth will certainly depend on the capacity of the infrastructure to bring transparency and safety to the process. I am confident that the continuous evolution of regulation is critical to the process. Today's speed and complexity of the markets do not leave room for a grow first and regulate later option. Regulating securities markets is getting more and more challenging due to several reasons, and I would like to highlight some of them. Products are more complex than they used to be in the past, combining different building blocks in new instruments. Proliferation of shadow banking structures challenges the limits of prudential regulation. As we believe that we have seen everything about shadow banking, new structures continue to come up. Technology is evolving fast and heavily impacting how securities trading occurs. Information flows are totally free using new channels of media, and cross-border activity is only going to increase. Therefore, the risk of something go wrong and trigger a contagious event that could do harm to the market and to our regulatory efforts is much higher today than 5 years ago. In that sense, we need to build market infrastructures that answer to this new environment and are safer as we go along. Investors have to feel protected. They need to feel that they have transparent, well-functioning, and solid processes behind their transactions. And this is our role as regulators. So, in addition to the need of investing heavily in investor education and in our own capacity, so we can be more efficient regulators and deal better with new realities, we have the obligation of to take regulatory measures that strengthen the marketplace and enhance transparency in the way securities are issued and traded. Market infrastructure's regulation basically should state clear definition of roles in trading, central deposit, settlement, and clearing activities. These activities were always characterized as plumbing, but they involve much more. In other words, regulation should establish the basis of a solid framework that will ensure not only that securities exist and are correctly recorded, but also that they are kept safe, segregated, and that when the security is traded, there is minimum counterpart, settlement, and liquidation risks. One good lesson from the 2008 crisis was that if there is a failure along this process, it may create problems that quickly expand through the entire market system, impacting acceptable levels of liquidity and operations, and seriously preventing us from achieving our main goal, which is protect investors under a sound financial stability environment. Well-built market infrastructures that ensure a higher level of market integrity should allow us to sail more safely through scenarios of stress, which could have a negative impact on the overall level of investor confidence, slow down this growth potential, and put our own credibility of securities regulators at risk, and naturally impacting our overall objective of keeping market stability. As we regulate this new market order, we also have the opportunity to assess better how this evolution is occurring and evaluating potential areas of weaknesses. Talking specifically about the Brazilian case, as we analyzed the recent developments of our market, we clearly felt the opportunity to update the rules regarding certain roles in the market infrastructure framework. We are currently engaged in an important reform of rules that will better define the roles of custodians and central securities depository entities. This move is more than an enhancement of the existing framework. As a matter of fact, we currently have a very general framework which accommodates different solutions. What we are now trying to accomplish is to improve this regime, creating clear and modern and more specific rules for different types of market participants. In doing this, we are updating our regulatory background and answering to demands arisen from market developments. One of the main drivers of this reform was the creation in 2002 in Brazil of the Brazilian payment system. Since then, transactions that are considered systemically important must be clear and settled through a central counterpart. In practice, the vast majority of transactions are already centrally clear in Brazil, in line with recommendations of the Financial Stability Board and IOSCO. The public hearing of this current proposal we have has just ended. What we have heard from the market participants was very important. And now we are going back to the drawing board and try to issue the new rules in the next few months. With the present reform, we are trying to replicate a system that already works for equities, through which full immobilization and dematerialization is achieved in a central securities depository. And we expand this to other classes of assets that are publicly distributed and traded in our markets. Currently, these other assets are merely registered in an authorized entity, a trade repository. Even if this registration process brings some informational benefits, it's not able to ensure the existence and the immobilization of the asset. Thus, the fact that an asset is registered is not enough and fully adequate for public distribution and trading. As I told before, a CSD immobilizes and dematerializes an asset, and it is the only way to have a safer marketplace. A system like this only works based on a chain of obligations and responsibilities involving different participants. And an important part of this structure is in the reconciliation procedures that shall be mandatory. Besides, we are reinforcing with the new rules the beneficial owner model traditionally adopted in Brazil, which reduces intermediaries' moral hazard and enhances the quality of risk management by CCPs. The new rules will bring additional integrity to the securities markets and minimizes and manages the risks associated with safekeeping, ownership, and transfer process. After this current reform, we should start the discussion of central depositary activities too. As a result, they will give the market agents a superior level of confidence to invest and trade these securities in the Brazilian capital markets. This type of reform should not be viewed as over-regulation or as bringing extra burden to players. As you showed in your slides, Mark, on the contrary, we believe that as these reforms are incorporated by the markets, we will bring cost efficiency, safety, and reliability, and it will be much better off to deal with the technological changes. Even before we had any preliminary version of these reforms, we are already discussing with market participants our intentions and showing their coherence with other initiatives around the world. Since Brazilian market development is directly linked with the perception of safety by international investors, the main agents understood the general idea before a more concrete discussion went on. The perception of the value of this kind of reform is an important step in order to get the necessary support. After this general view, I would like to wrap up talking about what we are carrying out in terms of market infrastructure in what relates to derivatives. I believe that what we have done in Brazil in terms of over-the-counter derivatives is working well and has to do with creating and maintaining a solid market infrastructure. One of the main characteristics of the Brazilian derivatives market is that about 80% of all derivatives are already exchanged traded. The remaining 20%, which is OTC traded, is already subject to mandatory reporting to a trade repository. Such reporting is required by rules enacted by both the Central Bank and the Brazilian Commission, and more recently by law. The law set out that derivative transactions must be registered in order to be legally valid. In addition, Brazilian regulation prescribes all exchange-traded derivatives to be centrally clear and settled. Recently, the Central Bank and CVM have created a working group to assess OTC derivatives on a continuous basis in order to determine the degree of standardization, material risk, and potential regulatory arbitrage. Based on this analysis, it may be determined if there is a need for mandatory central clearing for a specific class of contracts which are currently bilaterally cleared. It's also important to highlight that bilateral traded OTC derivatives have higher capital requirements than centrally cleared derivatives. In summary, Brazil is fully implementing the international recommendations regarding the treatment of OTC derivatives and central clearing structures. I believe we were able to learn from our hits and misses and understand some important principles that should be observed in terms of market infrastructure. The establishment of robust market infrastructures based on such principles is especially important in developing markets, once it ensures growth in a safe and sustainable manner. It's also important, as you asked how we should proceed in emerging markets, to gradually implement this architecture while the markets are still relatively small. Promoting sound conduct since the early stages of a market is easier and ensures a more solid framework, make it even simpler when an upgrade is necessary due to market evolution. We are aware that these new rules that we are promoting in Brazil will require some time so the market can fully adhere to them, and are considering this transition period also as an opportunity for us regulators to adapt ourselves so we can bring new standards of supervision and enforcement in this area. It's also worth mentioning that coordination among regulators has been very important, not only internationally, but also in a domestic perspective. Joint forums to discuss risks and areas of coordination at a national level are not always easy to work, but they need to be encouraged as they have become extremely necessary. Internationally, I would like just to restate the importance of IOSCO as we move ahead. In my first year as regulator, I could see that we are evolving fast, but we have to maintain that path. For us to execute better our role and be credible with other forums, such as the Financial Stability Board, the consistency in terms of representation needs to go hand in hand with the necessary attention that we give to issues such as market infrastructures. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leonardo. So for those in Europe who have to implement EMIR, I would certainly suggest a trip to Brazil and to look at what they have built. It's quite impressive from that point of view. So we have touched upon regulation, we have touched upon market infrastructure as enablers for the growth of capital markets. The subject we would like to touch upon is issuers' participation. Another important key success factor for financial markets is obviously their access by a maximum number and type of issuers. Let's now talk about market accessibility for smaller issuers. A great number of developing countries are creating specialized equity markets besides the main exchange in order to facilitate access to financing for SMEs. In Korea, the Financial Service Commission has created such a stock exchange for SMEs called the Connex. Jaehoon, can you explain what are the main future of SME exchanges? Why do some of these exchanges fall short of expectations while others are successful?
Well, thank you very much. As a matter of fact, as you may know, SME financing in the capital market is not a new issue. Everybody has been talking about this for how many years, I can't tell. And not necessarily in this instance, like IOSCO, but in many developing agencies and developing financial institutions have talked about it. Yet, we didn't really have the full picture of how to address this issue. So, so this is really opportune time. In particular, the SMEs are having difficulties in getting the better access to bank credit under the Basel III, while the low growth, low interest rate environment have pressured investors desperately looking for a market yield plus alpha yield assets. Therefore, if we are a little bit successful more in terms of developing SME market, then I think it will be a huge a step forward in terms of SME finance, but also the deepening the capital market, developing and developed world. Having said that, I found that the JAM committee report, which addresses exactly this issue, and I'm very happy to see that. Maybe I can bring in my own two perspectives in order to improve our collective thinking and collective working towards this this subject. Number one is the SMEs. When you talk about SME financing or SMEs access to the capital market, as a matter of fact, SMEs are so heterogeneous group. They are all different, and the ambitious venture business guy open his shop at the garage is pretty much different from fish vendor on the street. They are common in terms of their small amount of capital, but their profile in risks, their profile in their future yields are so different. I'm telling you this because not every SMEs is seeking for access to capital market, especially the public capital market is not necessarily suitable place for every SMEs. That realization is very important because we are designing a specific market segment aiming at the SMEs. So we need to better understand who are the most suitable SMEs for this particular financing tool. Having said that, I personally conducted a couple of tests how different SMEs are, and I took certain measures like innovativeness test or their future profit prospect test. So in a one way or another, even in a general threshold based test for their innovation, I would say only 5%, even less than 5% of SMEs are indeed in need of external finance, especially equity finance. And those limited number of SMEs are showing different financial characters, and they are behaving differently in terms of funding. Therefore, when we talk about the capital market access for SMEs, it is no equivalent terms in the capital market of microcredit. Microcredit is a rather universal way of providing the access for SMEs in their funding. But when you talk about the capital market access, I'll tend not to make an analogy of SMEs' capital access to capital market with the microcredit. That's number one observation. And the other observation, and I wanted to bring in as a possible policy recommendation is, in fact, the securities regulators are quite limited in terms of make things change in the area of SMEs' access to the capital market. Since it is a matter of enticing issuers to the public capital market, it is a matter of providing increased number of investable assets to the level of institutional investors, securities regulators can make a new rule book, can change its listing standards. But I often tell the others who are interested in Korea's case, Korea's experience in making an SME stock exchange, I tell them that, that is rule-based approach, a rule-book-based approach that might be the easiest piece of work when you really want to make a capital market for SMEs. Rather, the real challenges should lie in, it's a panacea, but as an ecosystem, how to create an ecosystem for SMEs, in particular, that particular segment of SMEs. And the other one is how you can bring all the responsible agencies and ministries into this particular policy effort. It's very hard as a security regulator to ask the education ministry, ask the Ministry of Labor to do this and that. If it comes to a tax issue, it's even daunting policy work. So my recommendation in that regard is, yes, securities regulator like us can champion this issue as we do now, that how to make sure the better access to the capital market for SMEs, but it is not only doable by securities regulator. Changing regulation is might be the last one, maybe the easiest part of the world. Therefore, we need to bring this important policy agenda at the highest national level so that we can mobilize all the resources available in the nation. That is my two perspective in this area. Maybe I can introduce Korea's experience later on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jaehoon. Now that we have discussed the issue of issuers' participation in financial markets, another important topic is investors' participation. And I would like to discuss that, having the example of Mexico in mind. So observers agree that the development of Mexico capital markets can be considered as a success story. This growth has been fostered by macroeconomics and structural reforms. But another important driver has been the 97 pension reform, which created a fast-growing institutional investor base, and the 2001 financial sector reform, which among other things included amendments to the mutual fund law permitting the development of a wide variety of collective investment vehicles for both retails and institutional investors. So Jaime, based on your experience, can you explain how pension fund and mutual fund reforms can foster capital market development? How important is it for small investors to access market directly and indirectly? And what are the prerequisites to make it happen?
Yes, Mark, thank you. I'll do it in English if that's okay, so you don't have to put it on.
Okay. as you wish.
Thank you for the question. And well, as it was said before, this is a sequence and stages in regulation. So yes, we started in 1997, but we have done many other changes in regulation before or afterwards. We did some changes in 2001, 2005, and currently we're doing also some very important changes in the financial sector regulation in general. But coming back to 1997, this was right after the 1994 crisis that we had, as everyone remembers probably, the tequila effect, which was very bad on banks and very bad on the economy of the country. And we had a pay-as-you-go system in the pension fund, no pay-as-you-go system in which younger generations of workers pay for the older generations who have already retired. At that time, the net present value of the of what we were supposed to pay, or younger generations were supposed to pay at that time, was 140% of the GDP of 1994. So that imposed a very large fiscal deficit in Mexico, or probably would have been a very large problem for the fiscal in the longer term. So we changed that to a defined contribution system, in which we had individual accounts for all the workers, private workers, because federal workers didn't had the change until 2007. But one day to another, we had to change and create a whole new market, especially for fixed income, in which we created an agency that is called CONSAR that looks over the new managers of funds that were also created especially for this purpose, with mutual funds that were created especially for this purpose. Let me tell you that I was the first supervisor of that agency for the newly created funds that were going to receive from one day to another 11.5 million accounts with around $7 billion. So it was a very interesting process. And this created, as I was saying, a new market with new instruments, with new investments, and a new way of doing in the market. Currently, these funds have in assets around $300 billion. So it has grown a lot in these years. And what it has done also for the workers is that in a country that we weren't used to saving, now people are know their own accounts, they can save, they can diversify their assets. They receive an account on a yearly basis, and then they know where their money is and what they'll retire with. But it's also very important that the regime, the investment regime that these funds had, have been also being more flexible in time. So when we started with this new system, you could only invest in government bonds. But as people had more confidence, legislator has more confidence, the workers had more confidence, and we had more flexibility in where you could invest. So now you can invest in capital markets, you can invest in other things. What is regulated is that we have only four different funds, and it depends on your, obviously on your age primarily, when you're going to retire, and the amount of risk you want to take, but that has to be assessed by the rules and also by the fund managers. So this has also turned into another market, and it has grown a lot also in this sense. Afterwards, we have also worked in transparency and corporate governance of the mutual funds industry as a whole, because this was the beginning stage of the mutual funds industry that we didn't have before. So in 2001, we also introduced changes to the mutual funds transparency and corporate governance, which also was in 2005 was also we introduced new instruments, which is called un bono corporativo, which is more or less like a medium-term and long-term note with special characteristics of how you can invest. So this was the change in 1997 helped us create a new investment which would eventually diversify risk for the workers and also for generated the investors' demand of funds, like you were saying in your slide. Let me just conclude by saying that from 2000 to 2013, net assets managed by the funds industry grew in more than 500%. Funds grew in 53%, and accounts grew in almost 400%. So I can say that this reform made a new market for Mexico, made a new market for the demand of capital, for the offering of capital in Mexico, and obviously the fixed income. And we are looking forward for new reforms, like Leonardo was saying, that are also very important to be established. And now we have a very competitive market in that sense. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jaime. So I think that we have established very clearly that to boost capital markets, you have to go through a certain reform agenda, focusing on the proper regulation, the right market infrastructure, stimulating investor and issuer participations. So all of that is extremely complex. It's very difficult to push, in each and every country. And I believe that to be able to do it, you need to have a well-articulated view of what all of that can bring to the people and the economy of a particular country. So turning to Arunma, what kind of arguments would you use, or are you using in Nigeria today, to push for this very comprehensive regulatory agenda that needs to be pushed through to boost those capital markets? And is the expected positive impact of capital market reforms on economic growth one of them?
Okay. Thank you, Mark. First, I want to say that I'm really delighted, and I thank IOSCO for giving me this opportunity to join this distinguished panel to share some views. And I just want to reiterate what's been said over the last few days about Luxembourg being an absolutely outstanding destination. I said to Jean-Marc that the only thing that he didn't do very well with was the weather, and I think today he's done a good job on that. I think I'll do it a bit differently. Let me assume that all of you are Nigerian citizens, and I'm trying to make a case for the capital markets. I know I'm speaking to the converted, so just pretend you're Nigerian citizens, and then tell me how I've done afterwards. Well, first and foremost, you know that our Ministry of Planning released a master plan on infrastructure and said that over the next 30 years that we need $3.9 trillion of funding for infrastructure. And you know when you want to travel from Lagos on the Lagos-Ibadan Road, you know it needs fixing. You know Niger Bridge needs fixing. You know the rail network needs replacement. The African Development Bank also said to us that every year we need $35 billion of funding over the next 10 years in infrastructure. You know our total budget for everything of the federal government is about $30 billion. So if we didn't pay salaries, if we didn't fund health, didn't fund education, we would still not have enough for infrastructure. The answer for me is really supporting us in the development of our capital markets so that we can find ways, whether through securitization, securitizing toll roads, whether through enabling foreign investors to invest in our markets so we can better support the huge infrastructure needs of our country, which also provides, in my opinion, huge opportunities for us to unlock the potential of Nigeria. So that's government. I know Nigerians are enterprising. I mean, many of you own your own businesses. Many of you want to start your own businesses. And time again, my chairman, myself, and others are told that your key constraint is finance. What the capital market does, and some of the reforms we've done over the last 3 years, allow you, whether you're a small company, whether you're a large company, to raise money from the capital markets. What I want to see amongst you young people that I see in the audience is the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Aliko Dangotes of the world. Aliko Dangote is the richest man in Africa. And what the capital market does is allow people to help you realize this dream. I know that some of what is a challenge for a number of you is that some of you don't have cars, but you see your neighbor has two or three cars. What the capital market does is allow you to invest in some companies that are doing very, very well. And maybe you'll be able to purchase a car and not feel so bad. Because I know that that's an issue for the social and political future of our country. We all want to create wealth, but we also want to feel that we're as wealthy as our neighbor. I also know that corporate governance, transparency, and accountability is an issue that's been talked about so often in our country. You want to see companies that abide by the highest standards, because often people don't realize how so committed we Nigerians are to ensuring that things are done properly. But you also want to see whether you, whichever state you come from the 36 states in Nigeria, you want to hold your state governors accountable. When they come and issue bonds in the capital markets, what happens? They have third parties scrutinizing them, whether they be auditing firms to ensure that they have the right financial management framework, whether it be rating agencies. So you have the opportunity, you have more information to hold your leaders accountable. This, for me, is even more important as we entrench our democracy than just raising money. Did I do a good job in convincing you about the capital markets? Not quite. Yeah. But I do think that over the years, Mark, when you look at research or empirical evidence, I think there's no doubt that capital markets are key to growing economies. When you look at, you know, data produced by the World Economic Forum, the Global Competitiveness Index, a lot of what you've seen is that the countries who have done better have had capital markets support their growth over time. Because of what I said, you need funding if you want to grow. And you need funding from within the country, but you also need funding that comes from outside of the country. And what helps that is that people feel that there's an environment, there are instruments that can enable them to invest their funds. So whether it be to support greater macroeconomic stability, whether it is to create greater employment opportunities, and all of us know that if we don't support our small and medium scale enterprises, we will not create the jobs that are needed in this world. And therefore, having instruments like my colleague from Korea talked about that supports small and medium scale enterprises is something that is critical as we look to support our countries in their economic development. Whether it's mobilization of savings so that it's to productive enterprise. I can very much relate to what our colleague from Mexico said, because our own pension reform in Nigeria is a little under 10 years old. And in 10 years, we've been able to contribute about $22 billion, a lot of which today is deployed to the Nigerian capital market. But for me, the two most significant, because we're all sold on raising medium to long-term financing, is transparency and accountability. That is what capital markets provide. But also income distribution issues. I was myself following some of the issues in Brazil and some of the protests. And I said to myself, look at what President Lula and Mrs. Dilma have done in terms of raising the bar in Brazil. But maybe the challenge is relative poverty, that some people feel that many people in most of our emerging markets, a few people are very wealthy, and many people are not quite there. But I do think that we need to think as regulators about how we can inspire much more of an understanding about the value of capital markets in helping income distribution and wealth distribution. And finally, of course, you know, the diversification of risk is something that capital markets helps us do. In your introduction, Mark, you talked about what I would consider the overdependence, particularly in emerging markets, on banking finance. And I think that as our markets develop, there are clearly many different types of alternatives in terms of funding, and therefore in terms of risk management and risk diversification. So those would be my initial thoughts around what is the story that each of us must tell as we encourage everybody to understand the value of capital markets in our countries, not just for GEMs, but also even for developed markets today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arumna. Clear evidence that regulators can be tough, but also inspiring, so that's great. We are running a little bit late. We have only 15 minutes left. I had initially in mind to cover the latest developments in each and every country. Because we have just 15 minutes left, what I would like to propose is potentially to take first some questions from the audience, if there are some, to respond to those questions, and then to wrap up the panel. If there are no questions, then we will move forward and cover the last part of the panel discussion. So, any question to our panelists on what it takes, to develop capital markets and to which extent they can prove to be impactful on economic growth? Yes, one question. If you want to give your name, the country you are coming from, and to whom you are directing your question, that would be perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Bert Chanetsa from the Financial Services Board in South Africa. My comment here is directed to the gentleman from Korea. I liked your reference to an ecosystem for SMEs. Obviously, altering listing requirements will not do the trick for SMEs. There is a lot of ground to cover before an SME can be ready for listing. Does the answer not lie in channeling pools of capital into SMEs through appropriate incentives and thus prepare them for listing at a later stage?
Very briefly. Once again, we need to be very careful in defining who is the SMEs in need of public capital. And having said that, if we identify them, then how we can help them come out to the market. And you mentioned already on creating an ecosystem for them to come more and to grow more. And the Korea's experience is somewhat based on what it has done for 40 years, its own economic development experience. So it's somewhat patronizing, but at the risk of patronizing, the government was very proactive in providing all the necessary services for SMEs to approach to the venture capitalists, angel investors, and other financiers. At the same time, we have long been maintaining the innovation policy. If you look at the OECD Innovation Index, Korea is very well placed, like amongst the top five countries in terms of dealing with the national level innovation. So through the innovation policy, we can help them out. I cannot tell you all the programs and the problems that we have seen, though. But one thing, an example is that we call it try again culture, because in Asian society, your face losing is a huge embarrassment. If you fail in a small business, it's a huge face losing event. So we encourage the failed business people, young people, to try again. And it is not only a cultural campaign, but also it is a matter of changing the individual credit information system. We have a very huge personal credit data information. For example, if you are in delay of mobile phone payment, you are registered as a possible delinquent in that personal debt information, because mobile phone payment was insured, so the insurance event has happened if you are late in paying the payment. So it is too severe for a young guy who wants to open his own business. So it is a matter of changing the systems to encourage them to try again. So, I mean, that is one of the examples that I can share with you. Thank you.
Arunma, you want to add something? Yeah.
Yes, I just want to concur with Mr. Betchan. I'd say that you do need an ecosystem. In fact, in Nigeria, as an economic management team, what we have done is basically say that we must start with the venture capital private equity industry, because if you don't nurture companies properly from the very beginning, when they list, they may not be able to sustain the requirements or the response to the requirements. So our approach is to take an ecosystem approach. But even prior to that, recognize that in Nigeria, we have a very young population. More than 50% of Nigerians are below the age of 30, if not even more. And so focus on certain sectors like technology that young people enjoy. So for example, our Ministry of Communications Technology basically put seed money in an innovation fund, and is that fund is being managed by a well-known VC PE firm. And the idea is to support young people in their business ideas, but also that all of us participate in that process, that they get mentorship from business leaders like Aliko Dangote, who I mentioned is the wealthiest African, from the very beginning. The Ministry of Finance has a number of business planning competition initiatives around the country that are supported, either targeted at women, targeted at young people. And the idea is, because Nigerians are very enterprising people, is that from the very beginning, their support services so that they understand what it means to run a company. And we are very interested in participating in those initiatives, because what we want to see is that when those companies then come to list on our alternative securities market, that they're very, very well prepared. Our exchange, of course, has revamped the requirements for listing, because before they were not really responsive to small and medium scale enterprise. So the alternative securities market, which existed before, today has what you have, which is quite similar to what South Africa has, which is that you have nominated advisors that work with you from the beginning and stay with you through the listing process. So my own point is that how those companies begin and are managed before they come to the official public markets is very, very important to their sustainability and to their survival. Thank you.
Thank you, Amna. Yeah, we have another question here. A mic, please, middle of the room. Thank you. Again, your name, the country you are coming from, and whom you are.
Thank you. My name is Lano from CEPS in Brussels. I'm from a think tank. Mr. President, you referred to EMIR. I wanted to raise a question to the representative of the Brazilian Securities Commission, Mr. Gomes Pereira. In Europe, a big issue of debate is how you supervise a CCP, meaning you have the center counterparty to which you contribute capital as a bank if you participate in derivatives market, and then there are the issues of margin calls. So how do you look at this as a securities commission if you have a well-functioning derivatives market and most is traded on the exchange? How, first of all, do you supervise the level of capital which banks contribute to CCPs? How do you supervise if there are margin calls done by CCPs, whether this is adequate or whether this is not adequate?
Let me be very straight to your question. This is a challenge we have. And I think we'll be learning that. One of the things I mentioned, as we promote these reforms, well, as the market needs time, we as regulators also need time. But the first thing that I feel it's very important is to understand information, to get information. We have been talking a lot about the reforms of derivatives, for example, that we have to get everything through exchange and so forth. But my question is, do we have the information that we need? We cannot supervise, and we will not be able to do so if we don't agree on a symmetrical basis what type of information we need to request. And this has been one of the concerns I have, and I've been talking to people in Brazil, the different agents in the market, about the quality of information that they can provide and how reliable that information is. So I think the market infrastructure agents will have to invest more in providing the information. We need to understand what type of information is necessary to give, and we, on our side, will have to be more engaged.
Thank you, Leonardo. Another question?
Here, Mark.
Yeah, okay.
Hello, thank you all for all your presentations. I enjoyed it. My name is Ugo Ikemba. I'm on the board of the SEC in Nigeria. My question is directed to Jaime from Mexico. I'm intrigued by the growth from 7 billion to 300 billion, as you said, from 1997. Especially, I think it was after a crisis. So how did you engender trust by the market for people to start saving through mutual funds? And then how did you sort of build capacity? Do you have local players partnering with foreign players to build trust? What steps did you do either from a regulatory side or from a market side to grow the market? It's extremely interesting to me.
Yes, thank you. As I was saying, the market was almost non-existent because you had a government that was going to pay for those pension funds through taxes. That's the only way you could have paid for that, no, or issuing debt. It was a sequence of reforms that took place from 1997, and we currently already have one in Congress. And now you have a whole different structure of the market. So now you have an agency that was created to regulate specially or only the pension fund system, the private pension fund system, in which it's a forced savings of the workers that have to contribute every month to their own saving account. So that generates a lot of the growth because it's a forced savings contribution, okay? But also we have new laws regarding the mutual funds and how they work. So in 2001 and in 2005, we generated new laws for the mutual funds, and it gave our commission also more powers in how you regulate those funds. And that has a lot to do with what was said earlier, that this gives transparency and more confidence to the market. And yes, because it started to grow because of forced contributions and because of new savings from the country, it started to bring in players from all over the country. Even in the capital markets, we just celebrated the 10 years of the international market or something like that it's called, in which you can buy stocks from most other parts in the world through our own stock market. So we have a very changed market in which rules are very clear, transparency is very clear, and this has generated a lot of confidence, and that added to the forced contribution or the forced savings for the market, plus the forced savings now that the federal workers have to do, because we had another reform in 2007 that also contributed to this forced savings for the pension funds of the federal workers. That also contributed to this growth that we have had in the past years.
Any other question? Okay, so I guess it's maybe time to conclude. I know that Ranjit, you are leading the emerging market groups at IOSCO. I believe you are sharing a group focusing on those countries. You know, if you were to, I didn't, ask you to think about that, but I'm sure you can take it. If you were to summarize all the things that we have discussed, you know, what is your view on, you know, the ability of future growth markets, you know, to fulfill their promises to their respective countries and also to the rest of the global economy? Do you feel confident looking at all the reforms, all the steps that are taken in those various countries, to achieve superior capital markets, and if yes, why?
I think Mark, I mean, everything you've heard from my colleagues is on the agenda of many of those who are in the room. I think issues about long-term financing, which you had Arunma talked about the very significant demands in terms of infrastructure development. These are not unique to Nigeria. These are issues that happen in India and many other parts of the world, including in Southeast Asia. Issues that Leonardo spoke about are precisely those that are also at the forefront of many emerging markets. The development of the buy side, the demand for funds is absolutely critical, and these are areas which provide a natural buffer to the kind of volatility that you see in the impact of private outflows for many emerging markets. I mean, for them to develop a strong institutional capacity is absolutely critical, and this is the effort that's being done within Mexico. In the case of Malaysia, for example, we have built a very large savings pool of over 1 trillion ringgit. That's close to about 400 billion worth for a GDP that's nearly the same size as the GDP. So it just gives you, and I will talk a little bit about that in a minute, because I think there are two issues that were very relevant which we need to put into place on the future agenda. And of course, SME financing is absolutely critical. I mean, it is critical for all of us. So all this actually are themes that come back to long-term financing, which is on the agenda of was a very important work piece that the IOSCO board has put forward. I think there are two issues which, if I look at it as you move on, needs to be put into place. As this happens, one of the challenges that we have really is the issue of liquidity, which has not been touched on actually in this panel. And this becomes very, very critical, because even if you build very large pools of savings in there, the challenge is how do you create that intermediation within the capital markets to create the vibrancy and liquidity in the markets. Many of the emerging markets have serious problems about liquidity. In fact, I dare say many other markets, as David and I were talking about, when we talk about corporate bond markets, we were struggling to find a liquid corporate bond market anywhere in the world. But this issue of liquidity is very, very important, because despite the very large pools of savings that might appear, and this is a sequencing issue, many are trying to build those savings pools actually. And once you've created that, how do you create that positive cycle of vibrancy in the market and liquidity? Now, this is a very, very big challenge actually. And I think this is something that the Growth and Emerging Markets Committee must look at, and I think this is certainly something that many of us around the room have. The second point, which I touched on briefly yesterday, was the challenge of getting much more inclusive participation into the capital markets. For many people, the capital markets are the domain of wealthy issuers, investment bankers, and what have you. For the average man on the street, either they have a trepidation towards participating into the stock market, or to them it's far too esoteric and difficult to participate. And as a consequence, a lot of the distribution of wealth is highly concentrated actually. And if you look at it, 40% of global wealth is in the hand of 1%. And this is a problem globally. It's not just an emerging markets problem. It's a global problem. And this is the real challenge for us. And certainly speaking from our part, if you ask me what was on the major items on my agenda, it's those two things. How do I now create that positive cycle on liquidity in the markets? And two, how do I create a much more wider participation in the growth that the capital markets are generating? We have a market that's today got it's the largest market in Asia, in Southeast Asia, as far as bond markets are concerned, the fourth largest, 2.6 trillion. But these numbers, to the average man on the street, must have some resonance. And that is a key challenge for us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ranjit, for this nice wrap-up. That means that I don't have to do it. This is even better. So I think that you know, our panelists have been just great. It was refreshing to see regulators talking about economic growth, about you know, technology, about you know, the wealth you know, of the people. So I thought it was very very fruitful discussion, very interesting discussion, and I hope that you feel exactly the same way. And I would like to ask you to show your appreciation to our panelists by a round of applause. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Now it is time for a well-deserved break. We will see each other again in 30 minutes, so at 11 o'clock in this conference room.